He's so keen to do your filial duty if it weren't for Sir Hugo. Bay's eyes met hers, charmingly rueful.
I will admit our present circumstances add a spur, but, he added quickly, I would have wanted to go anyway, for Anne.
It was his sister, Georgie would have thought, who would be in need of sympathy. She was the one who had been jilted, and publicly. But that was all beside the point. Sir Hugo won't just disappear because we cross the ocean.
Won't he? I can't imagine he'll follow us to New York.
Bay lifted the lemonade bottle, emptying the dregs over her glass. He offered it to Georgie.
You'll like Newport, I think.
He was doing it again, changing the subject. Georgie pushed the glass back at him.
It's all very well to play ostrich, Bay, but burying your head in the sand doesn't stop nasty things from creeping up on you. It just stops you seeing them before they strike.
Bay reached for her hand, balked by the fact that he was still holding the lemonade. The expression on his face made Georgie chuckle. It was a bit rusty, but it was still a laugh. Bay's face softened.
You see, he said, it's not so bad as all that.
Georgie shook her head.
I don't like to think that Sir Hugo is holding my past over your head. I'd rather be done with him once and for all.
We'd meant to return to New York anyway.
At Georgie's look, Bay set the lemonade carefully down next to the hamper.
All right, but let me deal with Sir Hugo in my own way. I'd rather not expose you to his unpleasantness.
Georgie didn't know whether to be frustrated or touched.
You know what my life was before, Bay. There's no reason to wrap me in cotton wool.
Bay reached for her, but paused, letting his hand rest on the blanket between them.
Maybe that's why I want to wrap you in cotton wool, he said quietly. Because I know what you've suffered.
He treated her like a porcelain doll. Not with his words. He was nothing but frank with her, or as frank as Bay could be. It wasn't his mind he shielded her from, but his body. It was a strange paradox. When they were awake, clothed, strolling arm in arm in the gardens, Georgie had never felt closer to another soul, more loved, more protected. It was at night, in the marital bed, that she felt the gulf between them, that she felt him holding himself apart from her, afraid to hurt her. It was maddening. From time immemorial, men and women had been coupling behind haystacks, but her husband was too much of a gentleman, and she too craven, to turn their tentative caresses to good purpose.
"I'm not afraid anymore,"
she wanted to tell him, but she couldn't find the words. And he would know her for a liar. She was afraid still. But she was afraid of other things as well. No marriage was a true marriage until it was consummated. Bay had never indicated that he thought of her as anything but a true wife, no matter the irregularity of their courtship. He had written immediately to his mother to announce their union. He had outfitted her as his wife, introduced her as his wife. But as long as the marriage remained unconsummated, the fear was there. The lady or the tiger? The marriage bed? Or no marriage at all?
"Well, don't," said Georgie shortly.
It was the closest she could come to broaching the topic that had been most on her mind.
"You said once you wouldn't put me in a glass case."
"Not even a particularly charming one?"
"Bay, Pax."
Bay held up both hands in mock defense.
"Aren't married people meant to have disagreements? We should toast Sir Hugo. He's helped us to our first argument."
"If you can call it that," Georgie grumbled.
It wasn't much of an argument when the other party wouldn't argue back. Although Bay did, she realized. It was just that he did it so quietly and in such reasonable tones that it was impossible to maintain any sense of being wronged. Carefully, she said,
"It doesn't feel real, does it, being married?"
"I imagine," said Bay wryly, "that it will feel more real than you like once you meet my mother.
You will instantly be instructed in the vast responsibilities attendant on being a Van Dyvel, and you'll wish I'd never set foot across the threshold of the Ali Baba.
Never that.
She hadn't meant to speak so vehemently. Displaying that sort of emotion made Georgie feel more naked than she had ever been on the stage. She could say something frivolous, turn it all into a joke. Bay would laugh with her, she knew. But why? If she didn't want to be set in a case, she shouldn't put herself in one. On an impulse, Georgie rose on her knees and pressed a kiss to Bay's lips. Clumsy, inexpert. She felt his start of surprise, his arm close around her waist.
"Better to be hanged for a sheep than a lamb," she told herself.
Her voice ragged, she said,
"If we're to leave for New York soon, then we'd best make the most of our time here, hadn't we? It's nearly time for the Saint-Gossette."
"It isn't quite 3. There was a question in his voice. Georgie looked into Bay's blue eyes and wished she were bolder, braver. Facing down Sir Hugo was one thing, propositioning her own husband quite another. Fear made her curt.
"I don't mind the time, if you don't."
Bay's lips twisted in a crooked smile. She felt his fingers fan out against her back, warming her, steadying her.
"Though we cannot make our son stand still, yet we will make him run?"
"Something like that."
Georgie drew in a shallow breath, wondering where all her words had gone. Her world had narrowed to the space between her body and Bay's.
"It is France, after all."
Bay gave a choking laugh.
"Truer words."
He rose to his feet and held out a hand to her, and Georgie saw that his fingers were shaking. He was, she realized, her own fears easing, as nervous as she.
"Shall we retire, Mrs. Van Dyvel?"
"Yes,"
said Georgie, and put her hand in his. New York, 1899. January. The bedroom Bay and Annabel had shared was relentlessly tidy. It made Janie feel more than a little unclean, pawing through Bay's and Annabel's things, dresses that had never been worn and now never would, books with the pages still uncut, a pristine blotter on a new writing desk in Annabel's private sitting room. Janie retreated to the baronial splendor of the breakfast room, where Mrs. Garrett had set out tea and toast for her, both of which had long since gone cold. What had she expected, really? A page torn out of a parish register with the details of Annabel's birth? She set the toast down on the plate, recalling dimly something Annabel had told her in one of their rare conversations. Annabel hadn't been born in England. She had been born in India, she had said, in a hill station, whatever that was. Did they keep parish records in India? They must, Janie supposed. One presumed that Colonel Lacey had had his infant daughter baptized. But India was such a long way off. It was, she thought, really very clever of Giles Lacey to have created a story that could be neither proved nor disproved. Odd. She hadn't thought him clever. He'd seemed a poor actor, uncomfortable in his own lines, blustering and awkward when charm had failed. Cunning, then. One didn't need to be clever to be cunning. One didn't need to be able to work knots with words like Mr. Burke to achieve a successful deception.
"Will there be anything else, Miss Van Dyvel?"
For a large woman, Mrs. Garrett was surprisingly light-footed.
"No, thank you, Mrs. Garrett."
The full oddity of the housekeeper waiting at table struck her. The sense of emptiness in the house might be more fact than metaphor.
"Where is the rest of the staff?"
"Let go," said Mrs. Garrett.
She had, Janie vaguely recalled, been a maid in her grandmother's household when Janie was a child, her husband a tenant farmer's son. They were as Van Dyvel as the Van Dyvels, and stood on no ceremony. Janie frowned up at her.
"By whom?"
"Mrs. Van Dyvel."
The "of course" was implied.
"She didn't see the point of keeping a full staff for an empty house."
But it wasn't empty,
The children were still here. And it was, Janie presumed, not her mother but Sebastian who was now the master of this great pile and all it contained. She hadn't thought of that before. The reading of the will, like everything else, had been delayed while the coroner deliberated. It was, she thought wryly, very much like her mother to have assumed the authority without waiting for the imprimatur of law. And why not? It seemed unlikely anyone else would be appointed guardian. They had been an unlucky family, the Vandivals. Where there ought to have been a gaggle of them, in her generation there was only her and Bay. And Anne. But Anne wasn't a Vandival. She was the daughter of Janie's mother's sister, a pale wisp of a woman who had married a war profiteer, a man whose immense energy had flared briefly and then been extinguished in scandal and ruin. Which left only the two children upstairs in the nursery.
Mrs. Garrett?
Mrs. Garrett turned, waiting impassively. Her dress was of a dark, heavy fabric, plainly cut, enlivened only by the ring of keys at her waist.
"Has a man inquired here after the children? An Englishman?"
Feeling foolish, Janie stumbled on, trying to come up with a story that wouldn't sound like madness.
"We had a call in town from a cousin of Mrs. Vandival, and, well, he seemed to think that the children belonged with their family in England."
Lies. Rank lies. But what else was she to say?
"That's why I came, really," said Janie, settling for a version of the truth. "To make sure Mr. Lacey didn't try to remove the children."
Was it her imagination? Or was there a scuffling and scuttling in the walls? She couldn't imagine Mrs. Garrett would stand for mice. Even understaffed, the house was painfully clean. Or that might just be its newness.
"No one has been here," said Mrs. Garrett, making it sound like an unalterable law of nature. "If there is nothing else..."
So much for a comfortable cose with the housekeeper. When Sherlock Holmes went to call, Janie thought with some asperity, retainers fell over themselves to provide useful bits of information. Mrs. Garrett just wanted her gone so she could get on with her dusting. Or perhaps Mrs. Garrett had a secret passion for French novels and only wanted to get back to her office so she could revel in forbidden love. One could hope. That scrabbling sound again. Moving very slowly, Janie pushed her chair back from the table, pretending to carry her plate to the sideboard. The breakfast room was decorated in a style Janie could only think of as ye old monk's parlor. The ceiling was coffered and painted with Tudor roses, thistles, and various other horticultural embellishments. The mullioned window that took up one wall was inset with numerous small panels of stained glass. The other three walls were all heavily paneled in dark wood, hung at intervals with tapestries that stretched from ceiling to floor. Was it her imagination? Or was the tapestry on the far wall moving? Moving quickly now, Janie poked her head behind the tapestry. Not solid wall, but a narrow passageway, and a small figure pressing itself into a depression in the wall.
Sebastian?
Nothing. Not even dust motes. The secret passage was too new, or Mrs. Garrett too efficient, to harbor the sort of dust and cobwebs it seemed to demand. Janie wondered that her brother hadn't ordered cobwebs crocheted from string and hung for effect. No cobwebs. But was that the tip of a boot she saw?
Sebastian, I know you're there. I can see your boots.
A wisp of white. Not a boy's smock, but the ruffle of a pinafore.
It's Viola.
Hello, Viola.
Janie didn't want to let the tapestry fall behind her, which left her stuck where she was at the end of a corridor.
"I would have come to see you last night, but I was told you were already in bed."
A small figure emerged from around the corner. Her hair was the same tow color that Janie remembered from her own childhood, but the rest of her was pure Annabelle, from the three-cornered face to her dark eyes, too large in her child's face. She held a doll clutched in her arms, the silk hair snarled around a painted china face.
"My mother and father have gone."
There was a challenge in the child's voice.
That's what Nurse says.
Janie stood, holding the tapestry.
Yes, I'm afraid so. I'm very sorry.
It sounded so hopelessly inadequate.
Won't you come out and join me? There's toast.
I've already had toast.
Viola slipped under her arm, small and fierce in her pinafore and buttoned boots. She turned to face Janie, saying accusingly,
They won't let me go home.
But you are home, aren't you?
Janie felt as though she'd fallen through the rabbit hole. She didn't know the first thing about speaking with children. She hadn't spoken to children since she'd been a child, and rarely even then.
This isn't my home.
Viola's shoulders hunched, her face twisting as she tried to maintain her expression of scorn.
I want to go home. I want my real home.
Oh, Viola.
Janie dropped down on her knees, her black worsted skirt pooling around her. If she was confused and miserable, how must Viola feel? Her parents had doted on her, spent far more time with her than parents were wont to do. Janie remembered the bleak days after her father's death, when she would creep into the deserted library to sit in his chair, pretend his presence beside her.
Would you like to come back to town with me?
I don't want to go to town. I want to go home.
Viola scowled at her, infuriated by the idiocy of adults.
Nurse and Mrs. Garrett say we can't go there. The house is closed.
Her words had the conscious echo of Mrs. Garrett. It was clearly a direct quote.
What house?
My house.
Viola crushed the doll's face under her arm in a punishing embrace.
The White House.
The... Oh.
Understanding dawned.
You mean the old house?
My house,
Viola corrected her. And then, sensing, perhaps, that here was an adult that might be used, she took Janie by the hand and tugged her towards the window.
You can see the roof just there.
It was a pleasant prospect, or would be in spring, when the trees were in flower and the walks lined with creeping herbs. The breakfast room looked out over Annabelle's knot garden, the herbs she had tended with her own hands, less formal than the terraces that led down to the river, with a view to a high hedge with a gate set in it. In summer, when the trees were in leaf, that was all one would see. But now Janie could see straight through the bare branches, to the outline of a peaked roof, set with humble dormer windows.
There,
said Viola, pointing emphatically.
What a fool she was. Of course the new house felt empty.
It was Bay's love offering, built from the ground up as an exact, or near exact, replica of Annabelle's home in Lincolnshire. The original plan, Janie recalled, had been to enlarge the old house, but a conversation with Ruth Mills's architect at Statsburg had convinced Bay of the folly of that idea. So they'd left the old house, left it and lived in it, while the new house rose stone by stone. Janie glanced down at her niece, feeling a surge of pity. How much worse to lose one's parents and one's home, living in hollow splendor when remembered comfort was only yards away, just beyond the hedge.
Why won't they let you go back?
Viola shrugged.
We don't live there anymore.
That, too, sounded like a direct quote.
Well, I don't see why not, said Janie. Do you have a coat?
She didn't know whether to feel pleased or guilty when Viola's haunted eyes lit with delight. Chapter 10 Cold Spring, 1899, January. Slipping through the gate in the hedge felt like stepping back in time. Viola skipped ahead of Janie down the path, her red muffler lending color to her pale cheeks, her breath frosting in the air as she made determinedly for the white house that sat well back from the river, on the site Janie's ancestors had chosen long, long ago, still homesick for their native Holland. There were no gargoyles here, no mullioned windows or stone facing. just a white frame house with a large central block and low wings protruding from either side. The original farmhouse had been burned down during the Revolutionary War by either the rampaging British or familial carelessness, depending on which story one preferred to believe. But Janie's ancestors had thriftily reused the old foundations in building the new. The green-painted shutters had been closed over the windows, giving the house the look of a comfortable matron who had nodded off over her knitting. A flight of 3 stone steps led up to the front door, framed in a narrow arch with a simple pediment above. Viola was already at the top, fizzing with impatience. Janie followed more slowly. In her imagination, she could smell apple fritters frying, spitting and hissing on the open range in the old kitchen. This had been her grandmother's house when she was a child. Her mother and her grandmother had had little use for one another, but she and Bay had been sent for long weeks in the summer to stay with her grandmother in the nursery up beneath the roof, where the sloping ceilings and dormer windows had made a cozy haven. Janie could still remember the smell of those country mornings, the chill tang of the air, the chirpings of the birds in the trees, the bluebirds, robins, and sparrows as foreign and exotic to her city-bred ears as a flock of parrots. "I used to visit here when I was your age," she said, but Viola was deeply uninterested.
"We're here, we're here, we're here,"
she said, bouncing on the balls of her feet.
"Can we go in, please, Aunt Janie?"
It was only when she reached for the knob that it occurred to Janie that the house, disused, might be locked. But it wasn't. The knob turned easily, and Janie felt her breath release. It would have been miserable to disappoint Viola, and she hadn't looked forward to the prospect of demanding the key from Mrs. Garrett. The house had seemed large when she was little, a sprawling place built for a large family. But in contrast to the baronial splendor of Illyria, the square hall felt low-ceilinged and quaint. Through the doors to right and left, Janie could see shadowed rooms, chandeliers wrapped in sacking, holland covers over the furniture. The fireplaces were cold and dark, the grates scrubbed clean.
"It does seem small after the new house, doesn't it?"
A flounce of petticoat and a flash of dark eyes. Viola was already halfway up the stairs, moving with the determination of the very young.
"My mother liked the old house better. She didn't want to leave either."
"Didn't she?"
Janie followed her niece up the narrow stair with its solid oak banister. Viola must have misunderstood, or reinvented her mother's words for her own purpose.
"It's very beautiful. The new house, I mean."
Viola paused on the landing, drawing herself up imperiously.
"Nurse says it's haunted, and she wouldn't stay there for a night if it weren't for the poor wee mites."
Janie bit back a laugh. She could just see Nurse in her white cap with her hint of an accent she tried to hide.
"You're a very good mimic."
Viola looked at her blankly.
"What's a mimic?"
"It's a..."
How many words did one know simply because one knew them?
"Like an actor. Someone who can pretend to be someone else."
Viola had already lost interest. She tugged on Janie's hand.
"Come to my room."
She didn't take Janie up to the 3rd floor where the old nursery had been, but to the 2nd, down 2 steps to one of the wings that overlooked the river. This had been an adult bedroom, Janie vaguely remembered. Dark and formal, papered in green stripes with heavy drapes at the windows and a large bed hung with embroidered curtains. Now it was an open space, scattered with toys. Janie recognized some from her own youth. A battered wooden duck on a string, the yellow paint chipped and scraped, toy soldiers in various states of decrepitude, lopsided tops and leather balls missing their stuffing. Viola pounced on the duck with cries of joy. She tugged on the string, sending the duck's wheels clattering across the floorboards.
"Polly! There's Polly!"
"Polly the duck?"
Janie turned slowly around the room, old jarring with new.
"In my day she was Mrs. Mallard."
Viola cast her a narrow-eyed look.
It's not Mrs. Mallard, it's Polly.
Polly, said Janey, and received a nod of acknowledgement. Someone had papered the walls of the room. In a stylized forest, blackbirds flew out of a pie, a king lolled under a tree, and the knave of hearts stole some tarts. The old blue and white tiles around the fireplace had been replaced with ones that matched the wallpaper. Cinderella kneeling while the birds picked the lentils from the hearth, Rapunzel letting down her hair, Jack shimmying up the beanstalk where a giant harp awaited him. Janey thought she recognized Annabelle's touch. The rest of the house, the little she had seen of it, seemed unchanged, with the sturdy furniture her grandmother had favored. But here, someone, Annabelle, had created an enchanted bower. There were doors off to the sides. A quick look revealed a night nursery with two narrow beds, forlorn without their bedding. On the walls, the cow appeared to be vaguely surprised to be jumping over the moon. Through another door was the nurse's room, the brass bedstead still made up with blanket and pillow, but clumsily, as though they had been used and quickly drawn into place again. Thump, 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 Polly the duck rumbled over the lintel. Abandoning the duck on the threshold, Viola clambered up on the quilted bedspread and buried her face in the pillow. And that, thought Janey, accounted for the rumpled blanket. A moment of doubt caught her. But hadn't Viola said she hadn't been allowed to go back? Perhaps she meant it in the larger sense, that she hadn't been allowed to go back to live there. She seemed, if current events were any indication, to have free run of the house. Small children burrowed like mice through narrow places, making their way where adults feared to tread. Janey sank down on the mattress next to Viola.
"Viola, won't Nurse be missing you?"
Viola scrunched her head deeper into the pillow.
"She's with Bast."
Lifting her head, she added in her strangely adult way,
"He had a bad night."
"Nightmares?" said Janey. She didn't wonder at it. Viola shook her head.
"Bast gets coughs in the winter. He has a weak constitution and needs constant care. He has to have mustard plasters."
"I've had a mustard plaster. I didn't much like it." Janey thought she was beginning to understand. Mrs. Garrett was busy with the house, and Nurse was preoccupied with Bast, who had a weak constitution, which left Viola to her own devices. Tentatively, she rested a hand on her niece's back.
"And what of your constitution?"
"I'm shamefully hardy."
Viola's voice was muffled by the pillow.
"I shouldn't call it shameful. Consider it a blessing, rather."
Before she was told not to be too strong or too fast, before she was laced into dresses that stole her breath and hobbled her legs.
"It's Bast you should feel sorry for, cooped up in the house while you get to run and play."
"It's too cold to play outside, that's what Nurse says."
Viola still had her head buried in the pillow and gave every appearance of planning to remain prone indefinitely.
"She's not wrong."
It was cold in the old house, too. Janey could see her breath in the air. There was a fireplace on one wall, a strange luxury for a nurse's room, and a scuttle full of coal still by the side. And ashes in the hearth. Janey slid off the bed, kneeling on the hearth rug. Fragments of paper were scattered among the ashes. Janey thought of the scrupulously clean grates downstairs. This was a small room, all the way off to the side of the house, easily forgotten. It might merely have been overlooked in the cleaning. But there was the rumpled bed, and the paper in the grate. A piece of paper had drifted under the bed, unscathed. No, not paper. A picture. On her hands and knees, Janey fished it out from beneath the iron bedstead, and found herself looking at Annabelle. But this wasn't the Annabelle she remembered, not Annabelle with her close-lipped smile and watchful eyes. This was a different Annabelle, with a bow in her hand and a quiver of arrows at her waist, laughing at someone just out of the frame of the picture. Janey sank back onto her knees, seeing the picture at once in both sepia and in glowing color. She had been there, too, hovering under the awning, doing her best not to be noticed. That had been at the casino, that summer at Newport, that horrible, painful summer. Janie was meant to play in the archery tournament, but she had never been very good at it. She had ceded her place gratefully to Annabel, who had won handily, receiving her trophy from a tight-lipped Carrie Rhinelander, the previous year's champion.
"That's my mama."
It was Viola, hanging over the edge of the bed. "Yes." Janie felt like she should say something more, so she added, "She won a trophy for archery." She had forgotten that about Annabel. She had forgotten about that first summer. Or maybe it was merely because she couldn't think of that summer without the pinch of remembered pain, the strain of having to smile and pretend not to mind, while Anne paraded past with Teddy on her arm and a large sapphire ring on her finger. It wasn't that she had wanted Teddy. She hadn't. But there was no one who would have believed that if she had told them so. Except, perhaps, Annabel. Janie hadn't minded Annabel. She had been grateful to Annabel, grateful to her for seizing attention, for giving people something else to gossip about. And it had seemed like Annabel was everywhere that summer, splashing in the water at Bailey's Beach, playing lawn tennis at the casino, promenading on the cliff walk. She'd put them all to shame riding side saddle and danced her slippers to tatters. Her Paris dresses, breathtakingly a la mode, had inspired more than one woman to run to her dressmaker with orders for urgent modifications. But it wasn't the clothes one remembered, not really. It was Annabel, and the sense of vitality about her. Her vitality, and the magic that seemed to surround her and Bay. The way they would look at one another, as though they were exchanging jokes no one else could hear. Janie had been grateful for the advent of Annabel, but she had found it very hard to be near them. For the first time she was struck with the oddity of it, the gulf between the Annabel who had taken Newport by storm and the Annabel who had lived with Bay at Illyria. Something had happened, something to change her. Annabel's humor had become more mocking, her vitality turned into something hard. And there had been the sense of a secret about her, something hidden. An affair with Mr. Proyne? Or the knowledge that Mr. Giles Lacey was just behind her, a threat to her and her children?
"Mama said she would teach me."
It took Janie a moment to realize that Viola was talking about archery. The child's dark eyes were focused on her mother's photograph with such naked grief that Janie felt ashamed of herself for the pettiness of her thoughts.
"I can teach you if you like," said Janie,
painfully aware that she was committing herself to a promise she might not be able to keep. Well, she would keep it, if she was able. Some arrangements would have to be made for the twins. They couldn't stay here alone indefinitely. She offered the photograph to Viola.
"Would you like this?"
Viola snatched it up, saying belatedly,
"Thank you, Aunt Janie."
"You're welcome."
Whatever else had been in the hearth was unrecognizable. Janie wondered if the photo had been about to meet the same fate, saved only by a chance draft. But why burn pictures? Pictures and— She poked gingerly with one finger. "Letters. Newspaper."
"You'll get your fingers dirty,"
said Viola importantly, sliding off the bed.
"Nurse says we're never to play in the ashes."
"Nurse is right." Janie wiped her finger on her handkerchief. The window of the room commanded a fine view of the new house, in all its Gothic glory. Someone had been here, and recently, she would guess. Someone had burned pictures and letters in the hearth. Someone had lain on the bed.
"Viola, has anyone used this house since you left?"
"Can I take Polly back with me?"
Viola was clutching the duck's string in a grimy hand, and Janie was forcibly reminded that she wasn't quite 4 years old. It was easy to forget that at times.
"Perhaps Polly had better stay here."
Janie found herself reluctant to let anyone know they had been in the old house. Not, she told herself, because she hadn't the right to take Viola anywhere on the property. Hadn't this once been her home, too? But because if someone had been using this room, it might be best not to draw attention to it. Viola was looking mulish, but before she had the chance to say anything, Janie heard the sound of a door opening downstairs, the creak of a floorboard, and then another. Someone was in the house. Newport, 1894. July.
Hello, Potter. Busy day?
Yes, Mr. Van Dyvel.
A liveried gatekeeper hurried to open the gates of the beach club.
If I may say, it's good to see you, Mr. Van Dyvel.
He forgot to tug his forelock, murmured Georgie as they drove through.
Forelock tugging is purely for you decadent old-world sorts. Hasn't anyone told you we're a democracy?
Bay jumped down from the carriage and held up a hand to help Georgie descend. The coachman was also in livery, in a caped coat and high hat that were absurd in the July heat.
Come back for us in 2 hours? Good man.
Yes, sir.
Georgie caught only a glimpse of a red, sweating face in between the coachman's gold braid and the low brim of his beaver hat. Mrs. Van Dyvel kept a full complement of servants, all attired in the Van Dyvel colors, orange and red with the gold emblem of a rising sun. Georgie had thought she'd stumbled into a fancy dress party until Bay had explained it was merely the staff, assembled to meet her. When Bay had told her they would spend the next month in his mother's cottage by the sea, Georgie had imagined something with a thatched roof and roses blooming below the windows. Instead, she found herself in a mansion that made Blenheim look like an architect's afterthought, with 30 bedrooms and gilded taps on the bath.
"Mother didn't build it," he'd said by way of apology. "She bought it from my aunt's husband, Anne's father, when he went bankrupt. It wasn't what she would have chosen. We had a much simpler house before."
"Hmm," said Georgie. As an act of philanthropy, buying an Italianate palace and filling it with liveried retainers seemed somewhat lacking in moral suasion. Her mother-in-law did not appear unduly pained by the necessity of playing queen of the castle. Georgie suspected that she owed the fact that she hadn't been roundly snubbed to the fact that the appearance of Bayard Van Dyvel's English bride had directed attention away from Janie's not-quite engagement, that now wasn't, and Anne's engagement, that was. As for Anne, well, she was a problem for another day. For now, Georgie was to have a day at the beach with her husband, frolicking in the sand at Newport's most fashionable club. Bay indicated the beach with a flourish.
"Welcome to the most exclusive patch of sand on the eastern seaboard."
"You are joking," said Georgie. The clubhouse was shabby, the beach narrow and choppy with seaweed and shale. She looked back over her shoulder. "Wasn't there a much prettier patch of coast that we saw from the walk? I think people were bathing there."
"Yes, but they were..."
Bay lowered his voice for dramatic effect.
"Ordinary people. The water may be muddy here, but only members can enter."
Georgie shook her head at him. "So much for your democracy. Anyone can walk in Hyde Park."
"Yes, but can anyone curtsy in the Queen's drawing-room?"
Georgie wrinkled her nose at her husband.
"It's hardly the same thing."
"For us it is."
The skin around Bay's eyes crinkled.
"Only with more seaweed."
"Van Dyvel!"
An elderly man whose side whiskers appeared to be attempting to eat his chin waved imperiously to Bay.
"A moment of your time?"
"It's that miserable golf club," said Bay under his breath. "I wish I'd never agreed to join."
"Hadn't you better talk to him before he shouts the club down?" Bay fished a key out of his pocket.
"Our cabana is 3 down to the left. You'll be all right on your own?"
Georgie rolled her eyes.
"I'm hardly likely to be eaten by a sea serpent, am I?"
"It's the jellyfish I was thinking of," said Bay,
his eyes on a gaggle of women in heavy black bathing costumes.
They leave a powerful sting.
Only if one cares enough to feel it, said Georgie. Don't fuss, darling.
The darling was for the benefit of the jellyfish, who were watching from beneath their parasols. Georgie's advent in Newport society had caused considerable thrashing of tails. Did jellyfish have tails, or was it tentacles? She wasn't sure, but either way she found them more amusing than intimidating. After so many years of living in fear, scrabbling for her bread, the relief of being a continent away from Giles, the luxury of having her breakfast brought to her on a tray, the comfort of knowing that there was someone who had pledged his hand and honor to hers, felt like drawing a deep breath after years of tight lacing. Let the jellyfish expend their poison to no purpose. She couldn't blame them envying her husband. Looking at Bay now, his golden head shining in the sun, head and shoulders taller than the other men, she could only marvel at her amazing luck. Not because he was a Van Dyvel or because he was rich, but because he was Bay. There had been a time when Georgie had felt the same way about Annabel, one of life's golden children, fortune's favorite, so sure that nothing could touch her. Until the Colonel's death had torn away the safe foundation of Annabel's life, leaving her powerless in the face of the Abbey's new owner, Giles. It could all go so quickly, everything lost in a moment. Georgie felt a frisson of superstitious fear. Those whom the gods love. But then the sun went behind a cloud, and he was Bay again, just Bay, who liked his coffee with 3 spoons of sugar and couldn't abide marmalade on his toast. And really, having to live one's life surrounded by liveried servants in bilious colors was more penance than gift. Mr. Havemeyer was becoming agitated.
Van Dyvel?
Bay cast Georgie a look of mock appeal.
You're sure you don't need me?
Always.
It was simple truth beneath the mocking words. She did need him. She couldn't imagine life without him. And that terrified her more than she could say.
Go on. I can manage to get out of my clothes without your assistance.
This once.
Baggage.
Bay leaned down to press a kiss to her cheek, but Georgie turned her head and the kiss fell on her lips instead. His lips lingered on hers, his finger lightly touched her cheek.
I won't be long.
Georgie waggled her fingers at him as he jogged up to the clubhouse. She'd told him she didn't mind being on her own, but it wasn't entirely true. She felt odd picking her way alone to the correct cabana, knowing herself the censure of all eyes. It was one thing to be brave with Bay standing golden beside her, another to be fitting her key in a lock and hoping that she wasn't committing barratry. The key turned, and she found herself in a simple building with 2 dressing rooms, one on each side, and a makeshift sitting room in the middle, crammed with beach chairs and other detritus of the summer season. A bathing dress had been left for her, Bay had told her, and so it was. It was an odd contrast, the simple building and the ubiquitous presence of servants, the silver brush comb and mirror waiting for her in the dressing room. As she brushed out her hair and put it up again beneath a deep bonnet suitable for bathing, Georgie felt like Marie Antoinette playing shepherdess at the Trianon. Perhaps she should be grateful they didn't bathe in cloth of gold. The bathing costume that had been acquired for her was of black wool, a full skirt over bloomers, as surprisingly plain and practical as the cabana. And yet tonight, Georgie knew, these same people who bathed in their narrow patch of beach in black wool dusted with sand would put on their silks and jewels, climb into carriages attended by liveried retainers, and dine in marble halls. It was all very odd. She was dressed, and there was still no sound of Bay. She could, however, hear the click of the door of the neighboring cabana, and a high-pitched voice complaining,
"Even for newlyweds, it's a bit much."
Georgie recognized the voice as Carrie Rhinelander's. Carrie had fallen over herself in organizing a Venetian breakfast to welcome Georgie to Newport. largely, Georgie suspected, in an attempt to gain as much ammunition as possible. Georgie slipped over to the window, from which she had a view of two profiles beneath two very large hats.
"I think it's sweet."
The second woman was also familiar, one of Carrie's satellites, a wealthy industrialist's southern wife, so genteel that Georgie could only hope she was covering up a far less genteel past. It would be nice not to be the only one of dubious origin.
"Don't be naive."
Carrie's voice was sharp. Her acolytes were expected to echo, not argue.
"You weren't here last summer, were you? They kept it quiet." "Kept what quiet?"
Mrs. Whatever-her-name's accent was so thick it made Georgie yearn for Kitty's London twang.
"Bayards fall from grace, of course," said Carrie impatiently. "Not that anyone admitted it. They gave it out that Mrs. Van Dyvel sent Bay to Europe for his health."
"Didn't she?"
Carrie pursed her lips in annoyance.
"Does he look like he's wasting away? Mrs. Van Dyvel told everyone that Bay was suffering from overwork and needed rest, but really he and my brother Charlie were in the same class, and it didn't sound to me like they opened a book. It was all boating parties and flirting with the Boston Belles."
There it was, thought Georgie, the real source of Carrie's discontent. She pronounced Boston Belles as though they were a form of plague, akin to showers of frogs.
"If you ask me," Carrie said darkly, "it was all to do with Anne. Jock thinks Mrs. Van Dyvel must have found them together and sent Bay away."
"Found them together?"
"In flagrante."
Carrie rolled the phrase on her tongue, savoring the scandal and her own moral superiority.
"Bay never paid the least attention to any other woman when Anne was there. And don't think Mrs. Van Dyvel didn't notice. Don't you find it the least bit suspect that Anne announces her engagement and Bayard appears with a brand new bride? Jock and I dined with him in London in April, and he didn't make the least mention of forming an attachment."
Mrs. Whatever-her-name fanned herself languidly with a paper fan.
"It was love at first sight. That was what Janie Van Dyvel told me. One look and they knew." "Oh, Janie, what would she know of it? She couldn't even manage to bring Teddy up to scratch."
Carrie shook her head at the stupidity of people.
"One can only wonder where he found her."
"Janie?"
"No, the wife. The English wife."
Carrie made Georgie's place of origin sound like a minor sort of crime, as though Georgie were the opening salvo in an attempt to bend the former colonies to Britain's will, or simply co-opt their eligible bachelors.
"Why, they met at the theater, didn't they? That's what Mr. Van Dyvel told my husband. A friend introduced them. Sir Hugo Middleman."
"Sir Hugo Medmenham?"
Carrie's eyebrows rose. Georgie froze in her spot beside the window, no longer the least bit amused by what she was overhearing.
"Do you know him, then?"
said Mrs. Whatever-her-name in her slow drawl. Carrie took her time answering, turning her parasol around in her hand, adjusting the angle.
"A little. At least, we know of him."
Sir Hugo wouldn't follow them to New York, Bay had said. Perhaps he didn't need to. There was an old saying about taint by association. Georgie wondered just what Carrie had heard. After a moment, Carrie said grudgingly,
"It's said that Sir Hugo was quite friendly with the Prince of Wales. He moves in the best circles."
Only of the masculine variety. The Prince of Wales would befriend anyone who could offer him fast horses and loose women. Friendship with the Prince of Wales didn't mean that the better drawing rooms of London were open to Sir Hugo. Carrie Rhinelander had no idea. And thank goodness for that. Feeling a giddy surge of relief, Georgie stepped out into the sand, saying conversationally,
"Were you speaking of Sir Hugo? We have an acquaintance in common, then." "Mrs. Van Dyvel! We didn't see you there!"
Carrie's surprise seemed a bit exaggerated. More than a bit. Georgie could have kicked herself for her own foolishness. Naturally, Carrie Rhinelander would know exactly which was the Van Dyvel cabana.
This was her native heath. She knew the territory, and exactly how to strike.
"No, I don't expect you did," said Georgie coolly, and had the satisfaction of seeing Carrie's eyes narrow. "Did you have the opportunity to visit Sir Hugo at Medmenham Abbey while you were in England? It's quite well known."
"Largely for its extensive collection of erotic statuary. The family home was primarily famed for being the seat of an 18th-century hellfire club, which Sir Hugo had done his best to revive, with some success. But Carrie Rhinelander and Mrs. whatever her name was wouldn't know that."
"Our visit was so short."
Carrie managed to give the impression that only time had prevented her from a lengthy stay. Georgie wondered how Carrie would react if confronted with a roué in a monk's robe drinking claret out of a skull. She would probably want to know the provenance of the skull, and if he had acquired it from the better sort of corpse.
"We will see you at the casino tomorrow, won't we? Our little customs must seem so quaint to you, but we do pride ourselves on our archery tournament." "Not at all. I adore archery. There's something so satisfying in watching the arrows strike the target, isn't there?"
A bit heavy-handed, perhaps, but subtlety was not an attribute at which Newport society appeared to excel. Standing on tiptoes, Georgie waved an embroidered handkerchief at her husband.
"Bay, darling, there you are. If you'll excuse us, I've been promised a dip in the ocean." "Mind the currents," said Carrie, lifting her parasol over her head. "They can be dangerous for those who aren't accustomed to them."
Chapter 11. Cold Spring, 1899. January. A cold current of air snaked around Janie's ankles, up beneath her skirt. Downstairs she could hear the old floorboards creaking as someone stepped inside. Viola had heard it too. Before Janie had time to say anything, the girl took off running, ruffled pantalets showing beneath her skirt, Duck thumping behind her.
"Hello?"
a male voice called. Then footsteps on the stairs.
"Miss Van Dyvel?"
Janie hurried after Viola, catching up to her on the landing, where Mr. Burke's head was just visible between the balusters.
"Mr. Burke!"
Relief made her sharp, mostly with herself.
"How did you find us here?"
Viola gathered the duck in her arms, stepping back into the shadows. Mr. Burke ventured the last few steps. He smiled winningly.
"The dragon at the house sent me packing, so I decided to set up my own search party."
Janie folded her arms across her chest.
"You mean you were trespassing?"
Mr. Burke propped an elbow on the newel post.
"You didn't telephone for assistance last night."
"In other words," said Janie, "I didn't provide you with an invitation, and so you decided to invite yourself."
"If I waited to be invited, I would never go anywhere."
Detaching himself from the banister, Mr. Burke stepped past her, holding out a hand to Viola in a businesslike fashion.
"Hello. You must be Miss Viola."
"Yes," said Viola importantly. "And this is Polly the Duck."
Mr. Burke bowed to the duck.
"Hello, Miss Duck. It's a delight to make your acquaintance."
"She's not Miss Duck, she's the Duck."
"Miss the Duck,"
Mr. Burke corrected himself gravely.
"I do beg your pardon."
Something that was almost a giggle escaped from Viola's mouth. She considered a moment.
"You may hold Polly."
"Thank you kindly."
Mr. Burke gathered the wooden duck in his arms.
"No, you hold her by the string, like this."
As Viola demonstrated the proper method of duck wrangling, Janie said quietly over her head,
"Did your business prosper in Carmel?"
"That depends on what you mean by prosper."
The humor faded from Mr. Burke's eyes as he straightened. He glanced down at Viola before saying, in carefully oblique terms,
"The coroner intends to reopen the inquest shortly. You're to be called as a witness."
"I see."
Janie's throat tightened.
standing up in front of strangers to speak of her brother's death. Taking refuge in sarcasm, she said, "How very kind of you to come all this way to tell me."
"The soul of chivalry, that's me," said Mr. Burke.
But he spoiled it by adding, with something very like real compassion,
"The coroner seems like a reasonable man. It will be a few questions and over quickly."
"Thank you." Janie pressed her lips together, ashamed of showing weakness. "I've never seen an inquest before." Polly the duck thumped against Janie's hem. Dark eyes glared up from grown-up to grown-up.
"You're not looking!"
Janie's mother would have sent Janie to her room for interrupting an adult conversation. That is, if Janie had been allowed anywhere near adult entertainments. Mr. Burke appeared unperturbed. He doffed his hat, saying formally,
"Miss Viola, I believe Miss the Duck needs a place to stretch her wings properly. Will you do me the honor of walking with me in the garden? We'll let your aunt come, too."
"How kind," said Janie. Softly, under cover of returning his hat to his head, Burke said, "There was something else." Janie could feel the prickles start in her fingertips. What else? What more? She felt as though she were blundering through a house in the dark, stumbling into rooms that were suddenly in the wrong places, tripping over furniture that had never been there. "All right," she said slowly. "Shall we, Viola?" Viola hung back, Polly the duck's string clutched tight in her fingers, her back to the lightly papered wall.
"I don't want to go."
Had Viola been sneaking back to the old house, making a nest in the nurse's bed? But Viola wouldn't have made that fire. She wouldn't have burned her mother's letters.
"We can come back again."
Janie held out a hand to her niece, half expecting to be rejected.
"I will take you back."
Viola didn't take her hand, but she did afford her a regal nod.
"My garden is this way,"
Viola informed Mr. Burke, and skipped off down the stairs with the obvious assumption that her retinue would follow. Janie and Mr. Burke followed somewhat more sedately, proceeding in the proper way, Mr. Burke first, then Janie. From behind, Janie could see that his hat was well made, but worn. Aping the apparel of a gentleman, her mother would call it. Janie sometimes suspected her mother would be all in favor of sumptuary laws, statutes making it a penalty for the peasants to live like their betters. And mandatory coronets for all Vandivals, of course. Mr. Burke paused at the bottom of the stairs, holding out a hand to help her alight. She was tall for a woman. Mr. Burke was of average height. When Janie stood on the bottom step, she could look him directly in the eye.
"What is it that you needed to tell me?"
Mr. Burke handed her down.
"I don't want to alarm you."
Janie looked up at him with some annoyance.
"There is nothing more alarming than being told one isn't to be alarmed."
Mr. Burke choked on a laugh.
"And it was plain speaking you wanted, wasn't it?"
They followed after Viola to the back of the house, past furniture shrouded in sheets and the dim portraits of past Vandivals, painted by local artists who hadn't quite got their perspective down, resulting in babies with bulbous heads and men with broad chests and tiny arms.
"All right, then, I'll be plain. There's been an Englishman staying at Hudson House."
"In the village?"
She didn't know Cold Spring well. It was dominated by the iron foundry, many of the houses company owned, the shops on Main Street catering to the workers, not the neighboring gentry. The Vandivals had exercised their feudal prerogative on the countryside, not the village.
"There are other Englishmen in the world."
Some might even have perfectly legitimate reasons for visiting the village of Cold Spring.
"True."
Mr. Burke reached over Viola to help her with the latch on the door that led out onto the garden front.
"He signed the register as Mr. Smith, Mr. George Smith."
"How very inventive," said Janie. "Come this way," demanded Viola,
and then remembered herself.
"If you please."
This way was around the side of the house, where the old kitchen garden lay beneath a layer of frost, lavender plants bedded for winter, bare stalks tidied away. They had been practical people, Janie's father's family. There had never been formal gardens, save for her grandmother's roses, bare stalks now, which had twined sweetly along the